Chapter 24, Antarctica. Sir Hubert Wilkins was the pioneer of aviation in the Antarctic. He had had great experience in the Arctic, besides having seen valuable Antarctic expeditionary service. Bird also had considerable Arctic experience. In 1926, he flew to the North Pole and back. The success of this venture gave him the desire to fly to the South Pole. The idea, backed by Bird's personality, gripped the minds of the American public. Raising money was comparatively easy, but expenses in America were great. All explorers, for that matter, suffer more in raising money for their expeditions than they do in the field. Bird was no exception. One thing is certain, the Bird Antarctic Expedition was the most lavishly fitted out expedition that ever sailed to high southern latitudes. But no matter what the equipment may be, man's efforts are puny against the howling blizzards, the intense cold, crashing ice, and yawning chasms which at any moment may open up under a camp and in the twinkling of an eye swallow it entire. The surrounding seas teem with icebergs, vomited forth by gigantic glaciers, or caused by huge tracts breaking away from the ice barrier, many of these being floating islands miles in extent. There is nothing so majestic as the passage of an iceberg. Nearly all have battleship bows with a ponderous ram extending forward from the water foot. In the process of decay, they assume fairy forms. There are caverns of limpid blue and wonderful arches. Many icebergs are tunneled through as if the work had been performed by the most skillful engineers. The amount of scientific work yet to be done is great. Now that the glamour of being the first to find the pole by foot or by air has passed, expeditions of the future may devote more time and effort to solving meteorological, geographical, and magnetic problems. If there are commercial possibilities in Antarctica, they are problematical. So far, the only source of wealth lies in the seas that surround the continent, and from which, in 1 year, Norwegian whalers have extracted £3 million sterling for their catch. Scott, Shackleton and Mawson found traces of coal, copper and iron, but only in small quantities. They assumed that under the deep ice cap lay untold mineral wealth. Working this, however, would present a problem of such magnitude and difficulty as to be almost insuperable. Like the Arctic, the Antarctic has demanded its toll of sacrifice from those who would learn her secrets. The tragic end of the Scott expedition is well known. Shackleton himself died in the far south from heart disease brought on by the grueling experiences of his two former expeditions. On November the 26th, 1928, the city of New York arrived in Port Chalmers, New Zealand. The Eleanor Bolling had arrived in Wellington 8 days before us, although she left New York a month after we did. Our long-winded passage nearly upset the plans of the expedition, as Commander Bird had arranged with the owners of the factory whaling ship C.A. Larsen to tow the bark through the ice pack. This was a help that no previous expedition had received. As the Larsen was now on the northern fringe of the ice pack, waiting for a chance to break through to the south, it behoved us to make things hum to get the ships ready to sail on the last lap to Antarctica. The expedition was cumbersome. The two ships selected for the job were small and slow. Without the aid of the Norwegian whalers, Sir James Clark Ross and C.A. Larsen, it would have been impossible to transport all the planes and dogs, not to mention personnel, from America. In New Zealand, we were received with open arms, every assistance was given, and the citizens of Dunedin tried to outdo each other in acts of kindness to the visiting explorers. There was a civic reception in the City Hall, which we all attended. Here, our leader stated the objects of our expedition. We were on a mission of science and exploration. There was to be no thought of territorial aggrandizement. We knew that it was only through the aid given by the New Zealand government that such an expedition of ours was at all possible, and in case of distress, a British cruiser would steam to our assistance. there was much talk of goodwill and cooperation between the United States and New Zealand. Then we went back to work. It was decided that the Bolling should tow the bark down to the ice pack, the behavior of the latter from New York having decided Bird against depending on the antiquated hull when speed was essential. At the edge of the ice, the Larsen would take over the tow and pull the City through the hundreds of miles of floating pack ice. I was transferred to the Eleanor Bolling, a change that pleased me. Commander Bird and the remainder of those left behind in America now joined the expedition, and for the first time since its organization, we were a complete outfit. Bird and six others came from America on the 17,000-ton whaling ship C.A. Larsen, on which also came four aeroplanes and sundry equipment. On the Sir James Clark Ross, another factory ship, were the four dog drivers, 94 dogs and 40 tons of dog food. Most of the equipment was unloaded in Dunedin and stored in warehouses placed at our disposal by the Dunedin Harbour Board. On December the 2nd, we set sail for the Bay of Whales, Antarctica, with the City of New York in tow of the Eleanor Bolling. Commander Bird now took complete charge of the expedition. He immediately altered the whole routine for the benefit and comfort of all. Three watches were established, so that the officers and men would be on duty 8 hours out of the 24, not as previously, 12 hours on duty and 12 hours off. All hands, including the commander and his aides, ate forward in the mess deck, and a general air of good fellowship was impregnated into the gloomy bark. As we got down into the higher latitudes, the sea increased, and the winds blew with greater intensity. The Bolling was like a submarine. Seas came rolling on board and stopped on board. Our rooms were full of water, and the common mess room, situated in the most sheltered part of the ship, resembled more a swimming pool than a dining room. Standing on the bridge, looking aft to see how the tow line was holding out, I would look in vain for the ship painfully dragging on our stern. The mountains of water in between blotted out everything. Sometimes we would see the City surge up on the crest of a wave as we climbed the peak of another. There was an awful strain on the tow line, and the repeated jerking threatened to pull the whole after end of the Bolling asunder. This small craft of only 800 tons burden was put to a grueling test on that unpleasant trip. The hero of the occasion was, as is often the case on ventures of this type, the most inconspicuous figure in the whole expedition. He was Dick Perks, a hard-boiled sea dog from Liverpool, whom we picked up in Dunedin prior to our departure. The galley was aft, and the after end of the ship was continually under water. Dick toiled and slaved at his greasy jaws in rubber sea boots that reached clear up to his waist. Many a time the fires in the galley stove were washed out, and the gallant chef was swimming around in his kitchen in a welter of pots and pans. In spite of these handicaps, never once on the trip south or back to New Zealand were we without a hot meal. Dick had a narrow shave one morning. I had the morning watch from 4 to 8 and was keeping a sharp lookout for ice. We were well south of the 60th parallel and in the region where icebergs should be encountered at this time of year. Perks came up on the bridge with a steaming hot pannikin of coffee and sandwiches. He had the good fortune to succeed in the first attempt. We stood talking for a few moments on the careening bridge, then Dick went down the ladder to the bridge deck below on his way back to the galley. The ship was making heavy weather of it, but it was possible to get fore and aft by waiting for a break between the big seas and making a dash for it. I was looking out to windward, and saw an unusually big green roller come tumbling and hissing along. Looking aft to see the effect it would have on the tow line when we would be borne to the summit, I felt the Bolling roll over to an angle of 30 degrees. The monster took the Bolling in its stride, folding the crest of the wave over the midship and after section of the ship. Dick, who was standing on the bridge deck waiting for a chance to venture down on the main deck, was lifted off his feet and dashed across to the other side. I thought he was gone for good. Running over to the ladder, I looked down onto the main deck, which was a seething, boiling mass of water. There was Dick, his body lying over the rail of the ship and his hands clutching tenaciously to the forward davit guy of the lifeboat. I managed to grab him just in time and dragged him up to the boat deck, where we took shelter under the lee of the smokestack. Not a moment too soon. A thunderous roar and another sea swept over the ship. We were flung against the rails, but, being so high up, the full weight of water missed us. Dick was shivering with cold, but he recovered quickly and served a hot breakfast at 8 bells as per usual. The sea was now too rough for towing, but we held on, or rather the bark held on to us. The city had the lower topsails and staysails set, and often when the wind hauled free she would surge ahead, taking the strain off the towline. This manoeuvre, however, caused both ships to drag the bight of the steel hawser through the water in a wide curve, a very effective drag. In about 63 degrees south, we came in contact with icebergs, and there was great rejoicing among the members of the expedition, many of whom were strangers to such phenomena. Practically every member of the expedition, with the exception of myself and about 3 other seamen who had more seafaring service, carried voluminous diaries. Pages were written about the beauty and majesty of these floating islands of ice. Later, when the sea was studded with them, out to and beyond the rim of the horizon, the glamour wore off and they got scant attention. Both ships were loaded down to the scuppers, the bolling with coal for the city of New York in bags and stacked to the fore and after hatches. There was always the dread of this breaking adrift and going overboard, but constant watching of the lashings and reeving additional lines kept the valuable fuel on board. On board the city of New York, conditions were much worse. The small sailing vessel was piled high with a deck cargo extending well above the bulwarks. On top of this again were the dog cages. When the wind was from aft, the howls of the imprisoned beasts coming down the gale were eerily penetrating. Night and day they howled, and their seasick attendants had an unenviable time looking after the poor brutes. However, all was going on as well as could be expected until we struck an exceptionally violent spell of weather. The wind blew with full gale force, and the sea was truly fearful. The continual slackening and tautening with frightful jerks on the towline put a terrific strain on the steel bridle rove around the stern for towing purposes. What we expected happened. The bridle snapped, and we lost our tow. The poor devils on the city of New York now had the grueling task of heaving in the heavy 30-fathom-long steel cable. They pumped away on the old-fashioned windlass for 2 hours before they had the cable on board. Later on, we steamed alongside the bark and with some effort managed to get the end of the steel hawser on board the bolling, which we fastened to a newly rove bridle. Then we proceeded on our way. 2 bells in the first dog watch on December the 10th, we sighted land ahead. This proved to be the 2 basaltic rocks known as Scott Island. They are the loneliest of all islands, and their existence in that deserted ocean is a mystery that no geologist can solve. The larger of the 2 rocks rises perpendicularly from the sea and is capped with snow. They form a nesting ground for seafowl, the water and air around teeming with bird life. One of Scott's lieutenants was the first to sight these lonely rocks, and until our advent they had not been seen since. In fact, many seamen were doubtful of their existence. Radio reports from the Larsen told us of our proximity to the ice pack. The ocean was full of icebergs beating north, and there was much floating pan ice. Avoiding one of these cakes, the officer on watch quickly stopped the bolling, then blew a blast on the whistle to warn the city of New York. The bark came crashing along with the momentum of the pull still working. The officer on watch of the city rang full speed astern on the engine room telegraph, but the antiquated machinery needed time to respond. In the meanwhile, the bolling went ahead again and was just getting into a decent speed when the city of New York went full astern. This strain was too much for the cable, which again parted, but this time on the city end. It now devolved upon us to retrieve the wretched hawser, a difficult feat on the rolling, pitching steamer. I assigned four men to the winch to heave in the cable by taking several turns of the stiff, heavy wire rope round the drum end. With three men, I commenced to coil down the hawser on deck as it came slowly off the revolving drum. The strain was too great for the winch. Without warning, the wire sprang off the drum end and pandemonium was let loose. A steel snake with the strength and fury of 1,000 pythons was at large. The cable running back into the sea gained terrific momentum and the men dashed for safety. Standing at the rail, I was exposed to a whiplash that might have knocked me 50 feet from the ship. My only escape was over the side, and I sprang to the rail and dangled over, holding on by my hands while the speeding cable lashed and sparked with fire in a mad race into the water. Climbing back, I expected to find several casualties, but fortunately, Kessler was the only one who suffered damage. We lost the valuable cable, but it might have been worse. Leaving the city of New York with the Larsen, we returned to Dunedin for additional supplies, taking on the planes and gasoline necessary for the polar flight. There I furnished some amusement and irritation to the crew by falling overboard with a fair visitor. By the middle of January, we were loaded down beyond the Plimsoll mark and steaming south again for the Bay of Whales. For days we pushed through the floes, and the quarter-inch plates of the Bolling stood the jarring and buffeting very well. The compass was unreliable, swinging crazily as we came nearer to the Bay of Whales. Grenley, our radio man, was a great help to precise navigation. He gave us accurate bearings daily and helped us to keep a beeline course, keeping in mind that a bee zigzags a little in its flight. At the barrier, we had a stiff assignment in the discharge of our cargo, particularly the Ford plane. Erickson and myself erected an endless transporter to haul the sleds from the ship to the crest of the barrier shelf. Bernd Balkan, Captain Parker, Harold June, and others helped us to get the big Ford out of the hole and up on the ice, where the skis were bolted on the fuselage. It was precarious work, for the ice was weakening, and we all breathed a sigh of relief when the job was finished. And not any too soon. Readers of the New York Times will recall an account of the crash of the ice barrier, rescue of Benny Roth. Columns were devoted to the averted tragedy and the heroism of our commander. As a participant in the tragi-comedy, my own version may prove interesting, especially in view of the many garbled press reports. After the unloading of the planes, I went aboard the City of New York to confer with the commander in his cabin. We were in the midst of a discussion when a roar vibrated through the air and the whole barrier collapsed, throwing a couple of 100 tons of ice on the Bolling. The bark heeled over at a rakish angle, and the steamer, lying on her side with a dangerous list under the weight of ice, would have foundered but for the fact that she was moored fast to the bark. Against heavy odds, the Bolling slowly righted herself. At the sound of the avalanche, Bird and I dashed out on deck, both of us expecting to see the steamer go down under the blow. Now the comedy of errors begins. Benny Roth was thrown into the water and clung to a cake of ice, floating away with some rapidity. I leapt on board the Bolling, planning to launch the lifeboat. Bird ran aft on the City and jumped overboard. He was numbed and frozen by the ice-cold water and in imminent danger of drowning or being crushed. His act was a courageous piece of folly. Joe de Canal was hanging over the side on a rope, and Harrison was clinging to a rope suspended from the edge of the barrier. I asked de Canal what he intended to do. His reply astounded me. "I must save Harry! I must save Harry!" How he meant to do it was beyond my imagination. He leapt overboard, and I proceeded with the launching of the boat. A line was thrown out to Bird, but a fellow with visions of a Carnegie medal slid down the rope. We had to pull him out first, and then get the commander, who was paddling for life down under the steamer's counter. Rescuing the rescuers was almost fatal to poor Benny Roth. Captain Brown and I launched the lifeboat, and we picked up de Canal and the sundry life belts and rings which had been tossed overboard. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Harry Adams, mate of the City of New York, rescued Benny Roth in a dinghy. Part of this episode was caught by the alert movie men, but their request for several retakes to complete the scenario was repulsed by the commander. They were quite serious in the request, but there was the possibility that the picture record would differ considerably from the press account. Both ships were now driven into the ice-packed bay, where we managed to transfer the few remaining tons of cargo onto the City of New York. Down at the barrier, there was again a reshuffling of the expedition, those who were to remain on the ice and those who were to take the ships back to New Zealand. Personally, I had no wish to remain on the continent. I foresaw the months of monotony cooped up in the huts with little to do. Hammering back and forth through the Antarctic Sea struck me as being more in my line. I was a sailor. The majority of the landing party were of little use aboard ships, as can be readily understood from the fact that most were on their first big venture abroad. During the time spent in the Bay of Whales, we had ample opportunity of studying the formation of the ice barrier. My own conclusions were that the section of the barrier at which we lay was an overhanging lip of ice, increasing in depth as it receded farther to the south towards the main body of the Ross ice shelf. The constant breaking off of huge portions testified to a pressure ever at work. Establishing a base anywhere close to the bay was fraught with grave risk, but the difficulty of transporting stores and equipment too far inland must have decided Byrd on making camp so close to open water. Nowhere in the world have I seen so many whales as in the bay named after these ocean mammals. It was not an unusual sight to see from 10 to 20 of the monsters swimming across the bay in perfect formation, diving and blowing as if under a skilled sergeant major whale. Many a mother had a baby by her side, no doubt as proud of her offspring as the most devoted parent in the human family. In one day, the chasers attached to the factory ship C.A. Larson caught 13 whales. From the bridge of the Bolling, I witnessed two of these catches. The stricken whales, on being harpooned, immediately sounded, taking with them in the dive hundreds of fathoms of line attached to the harpoon. When they came to the surface to blow, they expelled blood in fountains until the sea was dyed crimson. The poor brutes kept sounding and emerging for over an hour until finally they expired. Then the whale chaser came alongside his prize. An air hose was inserted into the carcass, and the huge hulk inflated to ensure buoyancy. The catch was flagged to denote who caught it, and the chaser was off to hunt for more victims. On Saturday, February the 2nd, we finished unloading our cargo, immediately steaming away at full speed on our 2,300-mile journey back to New Zealand. We were to attempt another trip south through the pack again to bring with us the remainder of the stores left behind in Dunedin. Where one large ship would have accomplished the landing of the complete equipment for the winter party on the ice, two vessels were ferrying back and forth through the most turbulent seas in both hemispheres. We practically rolled our way back to Dunedin. The ship being empty was like a cork on the water, and it was nothing unusual to put the wings of the navigating bridge into the tops of the mighty combers. Back at the base, the dogs were kept going night and day, transporting back to the newly constructed camp the stores dumped on the barrier's edge. Byrd had named this Little America. It took 27 dogs to haul back the Ford fuselage, the most important item in the expedition. On the bark, they were having a tough time. The commander was reconnoitring the barrier for a suitable landing place where he could get the remainder of his supplies ashore. They were repeatedly driven out to sea by violent squalls and blizzards. The commander now realized how futile were the engines on the clumsy bark. Were it not for Teddy Bear, the engineer on the City of New York, Finney would have been written a dozen times to her career as an expeditionary ship. He nursed those antiquated engines with the care of a devoted mother, crawling under the boilers, adjusting some obscure valve, or rendering first aid to a leaky joint. Like Bernd Balken, he was extremely conscientious. The success of the Byrd Antarctic expedition can in many ways be attributed to the good work of Teddy and Bernd. Teddy built the steel radio towers at the base, kept the city of New York running, and during our enforced stay in New Zealand, held the remnants of the expedition together with his unswerving sense of duty and honesty. Balken was our crack aviator. He flew the plane to the pole and back. He knew to a pound the weight his craft would carry under varying stresses. He was an accomplished athlete, too. In boxing, wrestling, and skiing, he was the champion of the expedition. He also had a flair for sketching and painting. We arrived safely in Dunedin on February 15th. For the 4 days prior to our arrival, we had covered but 150 miles. The sensation of having solid land under our feet once more was pleasant. The return cargo was waiting on the dock, and loading commenced immediately. Brophy, who had been second in command leaving America, had arranged for us to take relief supplies to Campbell Island. He had been acting queerly since arriving in New Zealand, however. The strain of his position had created a mental disorder, and we looked askance at his decision to sail with us. 36 hours of intensive work loading the ship in Dunedin, and we were off to sea again in the face of a southwest gale. We had to anchor for the night in Port Chalmers, awaiting a favourable lull in the weather. In Port Chalmers, Harry King, one of the most efficient deck officers we had, left the ship on a matter of personal principle. His going was a great loss to the expedition, but I realised that he was placing honour before fictitious glory. There were now but two navigators on the ship, Captain Brown and myself, so we arranged to split the duties of handling the vessel between us in equal divisions of time. The forward hatch was covered with dog cages, coal, and an automobile. Aft, we carried a huge deck cargo of coal. In this overloaded state, we received an awful buffeting on our third trip south to the pack. The steamer was awash fore and aft, and it seemed a miracle she kept afloat. Brophy was now developing strange ideas. He sent voluminous radiograms to Commander Byrd, some of them long enough to pass as short stories. Byrd, tired of answering them, told him to stop. Brophy had suddenly taken a fierce dislike both to Byrd and Brown, but became very friendly with myself, a direct contradiction to his former attitude. Then he conceived the brilliant plan of running a counter-expedition to the pole. I was to take over the ship and head for Scott's old headquarters in McMurdo Sound. He pointed out that we had all the requisites for an efficient expedition: an aeroplane, plenty of dogs, sufficient stores. I listened politely, but took no heed. I knew he was unwell. Then he succumbed to the obsession that Brown was going to shoot him. Taking a small bell tent, he moved aft and pitched on the after hatch, exposed to wind, sea, rain, and sleet. How he managed to cling to the surface of the slippery hatch, he himself alone knew. Thereafter, with bedding and a typewriter, he disappeared from sight, and occasionally we would go aft to see that he was still aboard. What a strange spectacle! There was Brophy, the man who in New York had interviewed Ford, Rockefeller, and all the captains of American industry, who had raised huge sums of money for the expedition, now sitting half deranged in a howling gale, in a tent pitched on the hatch of a tiny ship, rolling her rails under in the Arctic Ocean. His literary efforts on the typewriter were religious plays. Byrd, informed of the facts, chided the poor fellow mildly on the counter-expeditionary move. The weather meantime was growing steadily worse, and reports from the whalers stated that the ice pack was freezing rapidly. We were all anxious to get through, but knew there would be no return. The season was too far advanced. The city of New York was heading northwards, bound for New Zealand, and encountering difficulty in forcing a passage through the ice. The Larsen was standing by, however, and would go to the rescue if anything untoward happened. Captain Nilsson of the C.A. Larsen certainly went out of his way to help the bird expedition. His ship was a halfway house and bunker station combined. All nations helped, bar the United States. The city of New York was held up at the Panama Canal, and some of our men were arrested. The Eleanor Bolling was stopped by the U.S. Coast Guard under suspicion of being a rum runner and boarded. Neither department apologized. If nothing else, the expedition gave us a forceful lesson in international courtesy, in which I regret to say the United States showed decided inferiority. Commander Byrd, on hearing from the whalers that the ice pack was fast closing up, now ordered the Bolling back to New Zealand. It was a bitter order for us, as we were anxious to unload our cargo in the Bay of Whales. Brophy now became insistent on running the counter-expedition, but I coaxed him back to his airy wigwam on the hatch. As the stores for Campbell Island were underneath several hundred tons of expedition cargo, we returned to New Zealand without calling at the island. I should have liked to visit there to study the bird and animal life with which this desolate pinpoint of land is bountifully infested. The seal rookeries are the richest in the Antipodes and provide valuable furs unlike the huge hair seals of Antarctica. About the end of the first week in March, we arrived back in Dunedin to discharge our cargo and prepare for the long tie-up until the following year, when we should return to the Bay of Whales to bring back the ice party. Brophy was relieved of his position with the expedition, and our New Zealand agent took complete charge. The City of New York arrived in Dunedin about the 15th after suffering a terrible hammering on the trip. There was much dissension on board and rumours of a thorough cleaning up of the expedition. All of those considered superfluous were to be sent back to the United States. This caused much hard feeling, and many considered their dismissal unjust. We lost our two best firemen. They had practically fired the vessel single-handed from America to New Zealand and taught the green crew the ethics of the stokehold. But George Sjogren and John Olson were but plain merchant firemen, so they were dispensed with. I felt that if the commander had known the value of their services, this would never have happened. Melville dismissed Arthur Berlin, a great favourite and a hardy Chicagoan. This caused much astonishment, as Berlin had been one of a group who signed a radiogram sent to the commander pleading for the captain when a rumour of his dismissal was being noised around. Berlin was on the passenger steamer in Wellington ready to sail with the other dismissed members for San Francisco when he received instructions to return to Dunedin. Teddy Bear had put his case before Byrd and secured his reprieve. Both ships had now but skeleton crews, and we prepared to settle down for the long wait in New Zealand. The batch of Alaskan Huskies brought out from Canada by Alan Innes Taylor at enormous expense were now sent up to the Hermitage on Mount Cook, a snow-covered mountain on the South Island. The dogs were used to transport lumber and building material for the construction of an alpine hut across an ice glacier high up on the mountainside. The New Zealand government were in a quandary about these dogs. They had received numerous protests from sheep ranchers about the danger of having such savage brutes in the country. Had any escaped, it would have been fatal, owing to the possibility of interbreeding with the New Zealand sheepdog. On board both ships, we settled down to a steady routine. I had the ship overhauled, cleaned, and painted so that she looked like a builder's model instead of the battered little tramp of the Antarctic wastes. On numerous occasions, I took advantage of invitations to go hunting and pig-sticking. During the expedition, we were in constant radio communication with the United States and had free radiogram facilities. As a result, we were in closer contact with home than people separated by a few hundred miles. One member of the expedition, to ensure a heavy mail, made a point of writing to every celebrity and near celebrity in America. He carried an address book like the New York telephone directory and had specially printed reply forms. Paul Sipple, the Boy Scout, had the largest fan mail in the expedition. This was due to the amount of publicity given to his selection by Commander Byrd to represent the Boy Scouts of America. In contrast to Sipple, Chips Gold, our carpenter, received one postcard in the 2 years of our absence, yet he was one of the most popular men on the expedition. Brophy was adjudged mentally unsound by a board of competent judges, and his deportation back to the United States was ordered. Poor Dick, his collapse was pathetic. One evening I went to his hotel to see him. On the door was pinned a notice saying, "Richard Gale Brophy is dead, but friends of Dick Brophy may call on Gale Richards." Then followed an address. During his stay in New Zealand, he made American history by appearing publicly in Antarctic clothing, even dining in public in this unconventional toggery. Later in America, he staged another suicide. One day at Coney Island, the bathing box attendants noticed that one of the cubicles remained locked an unusually long time. They forced open the door and discovered a complete suit of clothes, a hat, and boots. Searching the pockets, the attendants found documents and bird radiograms establishing the identity of the owner. But the strangest document of all was the one in which Brophy wrote that he was going to take a long, long swim until the waters closed over his head. Signed, Richard Gale Brophy. For days this created a sensation in the press. Large headlines announced the fact that second-in-command of the bird expedition commits suicide at Coney Island. A week afterwards, someone saw Brophy, in semi-disguise, on Broadway. He then disappeared for a while. When the epochal flight of Bird to the South Pole was being broadcast all over the world, the editor of the Omaha Bee was putting the finishing touches to the story of Bird's glorious victory when an inconspicuous member of his staff interrupted him. "Say, you got that all wrong. Let me write it. Look at that and that." The editor was astonished at finding anyone in the vicinity of Omaha who would have even a passing knowledge of Antarctica. But being a wise man, he merely said, "Ah, go ahead and write the damn stuff yourself." Then the editor did some grave thinking. Subsequently, he called for all the photos dealing with the personnel of the expedition. Sure enough, he recognized his subordinate. It was none other than Dick Brophy. He called him to his office and asked him for an explanation. Poor Richard broke down, and the following day he disappeared. Time passed quickly. November came. On the 28th, Commander Bird, Harold June, and Captain McKinley stepped aboard the Ford trimotor monoplane Floyd Bennett and, with Burnt Balkan at the stick, took off at 3:30 p.m. for the South Pole. The pilot nursed the plane over the head of the pass at Liv's Glacier on Mount Nansen, sacrificing 250 pounds weight of food to enable him to do it. He cleared the dreaded hump with 500 feet to spare, certainly a masterpiece in skill. Bird reached the approximate vicinity of the South Pole on November the 29th, 8:55 a.m. New York time, and arrived back at the base 5:10 p.m. the same date, thus accomplishing, for the first time, a flight to the most southerly and solitary point in the world. The city of New York sailed on January 5th for the pack. 15 days later, we received orders to follow, bringing with us sufficient coal for the city, which, curiously enough, had left with but a meager supply. Bird's requests for assistance were now being made more insistently, although we on the ships felt confident of getting through the pack as in the previous year. To tell the truth, we felt slighted by Bird's insistence on outside help, and candidly did not believe in its necessity. January 29th, the Bolling reached the northern edge of the ice pack and prepared to force a passage through. The wiseacres on the city, disturbed lest we should succeed and cramp their rescue story, implored Bird not to let the Bolling come south. So again we had to turn back to New Zealand and traverse the long distance of 1,500 miles to fetch back a few tons of coal for the city of New York, should she require bunkers on returning through the pack. Meanwhile, the United States government and the Norwegian government had been asked to use their persuasion on the whaling fleet. Both governments replied that the whaling companies had agreed to render assistance on condition the expedition would pay for all risks incurred. Our contention that all this noise about rescue was absurd was proved by the fact that the city of New York, a clumsy bark with very little horse and less sailing power, entered the ice pack on February 6th and in 38 hours had negotiated the passage. The Bolling could have made it in 26 hours. The city met with bad weather in the Ross Sea and was driven miles off her course, with engines useless against the heavy seas running. For the last time, we left Dunedin for the south, loaded with coal for the city. The bark reached the Bay of Whales on the 18th and commenced to take the winter party and stores aboard. This was done without any untoward incident, and the Bird Antarctic Expedition evacuated Antarctica. We were now cruising off the northern edge of the pack, which was quite light and broken, offering no difficulty of passage. Again and again, Brown and I commented on the panicky pleas for assistance broadcast all over the world. We could have negotiated the pack with a dinghy and outboard motor, but that, although a record-breaking feat, would not have had the sensational value of the dread or danger of an unconquerable pack. At the right time and place, the pack ice is comparatively easy to negotiate, even though this period may only be from 1 to 3 months of the year. On February 28th, the city came north, having encountered little difficulty in the pack. We were glad to see all the old familiar faces again and exchange criticisms and experiences. The run north to Dunedin was uneventful. Bernd Balkan and many of my old comrades were on board, and from them we heard many amusing tales. The highlight of the expedition, the only part that had real scientific value, was the geological trip of Professor Larry Gold and his party to the Queen Maud Range, to a point of 85 degrees 25 minutes south. Larry discovered a cairn laid down by Amundsen on his successful trip to the pole in 1911. In the cairn was a note from the famous explorer, matches and oil, all in excellent stage of preservation. In all things, Amundsen was efficient. Even his passing had the touch of perfection, so much in keeping with his unconquerable spirit. Our arrival in Dunedin was something in the nature of a pageant. If we had been a British expedition, there could not have been more enthusiasm displayed. Tugboats laden with citizens came down the bay to welcome us. There was a civic reception given to the admiral and staff, at which all the dignitaries of Dunedin were present. Bird made a graceful reply to the speech of welcome delivered by the mayor. He gave most of the credit for Antarctic exploration to Scott, Shackleton, and Mawson. Some of our men were disappointed at the constant reference to the 41 men of the ice party who wintered on the barrier, and felt that mention of the crews of either ship was deliberately avoided. Bird, however, explained to me after the talk that it was unintentional. His talk was purely extempore. I readily understood the inadvertent slip and conveyed the admiral's explanation to my shipmates. Now that the expedition was drawing to a close and we were about to sail home, there was not the eagerness shown that one would have imagined. We felt that we were leaving home more than going to one. Such was the strength of the friendships made in New Zealand. The foodstuffs and other equipment that had been ferried back and forth on the Bolling were now retrieved from the warehouse and stowed on both ships. I thought that it would have made a better impression had it been left behind for the harbour board to dispose of as they saw fit. The City of New York, being the slower vessel, sailed first, bound for Papeete. We followed later and arrived in Tahiti about the same time as the bark. We had the good luck to spend Easter week in this earthly paradise, and had there not been urgent reasons to the contrary, I would, I frankly confess, have stayed there for good. The French governor of the islands gave a reception and a dance in our honour, where we had the opportunity of meeting many charming residents of Tahiti, including the former queen. But like all pleasant things, time sped swiftly. The task of towing the bark to Panama now fell to us, and this task we accepted zealously. The long drag across the Pacific was uneventful. A few, including myself, went down with malaria and suffered through the intense heat crossing the equatorial belt. About 500 miles from Panama, the chief engineer announced that our coal supply was not capable of bringing the New York into Balboa. We had just sufficient to get there alone. The tow line was let go, and the Bolling steamed for port to replenish the bunkers. We arrived quietly in Balboa, and there set foot again on American territory. Admiral Byrd had already arrived, having crossed on a Royal Mail steamer. He requested that Brown take on sufficient coal, then return to the city of New York and tow her in. I was still suffering from the effects of the fever and felt too shaky in the humid heat of the canal zone to be of much assistance. I went ashore and stayed in a hotel to rest until the Bolling returned. During my stay in Panama City, I took the opportunity to visit the ruins of Old Panama. I decided that, in comparison, the modern city of the same name looked flimsy and garish, and the native quarter depressingly squalid. I crossed the Isthmus of Panama by rail and rejoined my ship in Colon, fully recovered from the malarial attack. A naval tug took the city of New York in tow, and altogether we steamed out past the breakwater on the last lap of our homeward journey. Off Guantanamo, the tug dropped the bark, leaving the city to follow us northwards. The admiral had come on board his flagship at Colon, so there was something approaching a naval finale to our expedition. This was further enhanced by the order for all those who had uniforms to have them ready for donning when we came within hailing distance of New York. We were kept well informed as to the date and nature of our reception. The mayor of New York had set June the 19th as the date for our arrival and official reception. We were ahead of our schedule, so were forced to dawdle off the Virginia Capes 4 days to coincide with the mayor's plans. There could be no doubting the spontaneity of our welcome. As we drifted idly around in the still summer seas, many vessels bound north and south came close in the hope of an easy salvage, but on learning the nature of our business, they gave us mighty salutes on their sirens and proceeded on their way. A press and movie boat came down the coast and hovered around. This was the first taste of the publicity to follow. On the morning of the 19th, we steamed up New York Harbor to the accompaniment of screeching tugs and the deafening roar of steamships and factory whistles. It was a monstrous display and must have cost thousands and thousands of dollars. This last item was of much interest to those of us who were volunteers. Craft of all shapes and sizes crowded around the bark, eager to get a look at Admiral Byrd. My old friend Count Felix von Luckner came down the bay to greet me. In his uniform as an admiral in the German Navy, he made a striking picture, bellowing out a thunderous welcome to the Irish rebel-turned-explorer. By some unfortunate regulation, our relatives could not come out to see us. By doing so, they would forfeit their chance of a place in the public reviewing stands erected opposite the City Hall. Members of the expedition were allocated places in automobiles waiting at the landing for the drive up Broadway to the City Hall. Landing at the pier in Battery Park, we were swallowed up in the rush of the crowd anxious to view Byrd. Instead of landing as a unified body, headed by the commander, the men dissolved in the seething masses crowded around the landing place. After much difficulty, some of us located our automobiles to find them packed with citizens who refused to get out. They were going to be in the procession, yes, sir. Luckily, an American lawyer had secured a car for myself and Jack O'Brien, otherwise we should have been forced to walk. Mason, our crack radio operator, not only had to walk, but was refused admission to the reception platform at City Hall. He proceeded uptown and in the radio offices of the New York Times listened to the numerous speeches of welcome being broadcast by the City Fathers. After the civic reception, there was a lunch given at the Advertisers Club. All the celebrities of America were present. At my table were James J. Corbett, former heavyweight boxing champion of the world, and Lowell Thomas, the traveller and writer. To me fell the peculiar distinction of being the member asked by Admiral Byrd to respond to the many speeches of welcome and goodwill. That night we left for Washington and on the following day made a round of the Capitol. The highlight of our visit was our presentation to President Hoover and members of the Senate. There was one dramatic touch in the gardens of the White House that impressed me strongly. Stepping up to shake hands with the President, I saw a well-remembered figure standing behind him, alone and pensive. It was Richard Gale Brophy! This brought the expedition to an official end. On July the 5th, Jimmy Walker, Mayor of New York City, presented Jack O'Brien and myself with an official and public reception at the City Hall, where I presented him with an Irish flag that had been flown over the South Pole. The mayor received the flag to present it later to De Valera, leader of the Irish Republican Party in Ireland. Many months later, returning home after successfully escaping capture by one of the United States Naval Coast Guard cutters, I received telegraphic information that the Secretary of the Navy would present me with a gold Congressional Medal for services rendered. I accepted the medal